It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning. Welcome to Legal Defense. Guess what? John and I are in the same state.
That's unbelievable.
Which is has been a rarity.
I was wondering if you. I was kind of wondering if you even existed anymore.
Yeah, I know.
I heard rumors.
I haven't seen you.
I heard rumors
for ages that I disappeared.
No, I
that I existed.
Both. That's what was so confusing. I just didn't know. You know,
various rumors from throughout the galaxy.
Well, so
yeah, I missed you last week. I did the show alone. I know the week before you did it alone.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, and the week before I did it in by the Wind River.
That's right.
In Wyoming, and you did it.
I had just gotten back from North Carolina, and mm-hmm. we were still traveling, so that's why we didn't have the chance to do it. But here we are.
Here we are. Oh my god.
So this is Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Still Kirk and John, right? It's not John and Kirk.
Nope. I have not been promoted. I've not been promoted yet.
So hey, just before we went on the air, you were mentioning to me that Michael Griesbach, who is still an assistant district attorney up in Manitowoc, who wrote the first book about Stephen Avery. It was first called Unreasonable Doubt. Then the name was changed when the ABA published it to The Innocent Killer. And I heard that he was working on a new book based on, I don't know, maybe he felt like he missed the limelight with the murderer type thing and had to jump right back in.
He actually explains why he's doing it.
And, well, what is that? What is the explanation?
His explanation is somebody has to.
All right. Well,
it's something along those lines.
On Amazon, I think there's already a bunch of people that have...
No. Somebody has to, I guess, in his view, set the record straight, and mm-hmm. he's in a position to do that. He feels, he says, and I quote: "It may just look like we're all trying to make money, referring to others writing books and giving lectures related to the Avery case. But if you've worked in the system 30 years, you do care." End quote. So. Okay. You know,
well,
I mean,
and to give him credit, he was one of the main forces behind getting Avery released the first time around. Not that he was working on it, but he was part of the office when the office basically stepped back and said, "You're right," and allowed the release to go unopposed the first time around.
Right. And you know, he's a very, I think, reasonable, competent prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had many, many dealings with him, but, you know, he seems to...
So is this book out yet, or is he just...
Yeah, it was just released, I think, like 2 weeks ago or something like that. It's called Indefensible. The subtitle is The Missing Truth About Stephen Avery, Teresa Halbach, and Making a Murderer.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the missing truth, you ask?
You've got to read the book.
Yeah.
He would give us a free copy if we reviewed it for him.
Well, it's interesting that this is coming out now when... Things are happening all over the place on this Avery case. First of all, as we've discussed, Brendan Dassey gets his conviction reversed by a federal judge in Milwaukee. You know, and the opinion was, well, it was damning, really, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, really kind of slapped down the state courts. But then Stephen Avery's new attorney, Kathleen, I forgot her last name, she filed a... Zellner.
Zellner.
She filed a very lengthy and I think well-written motion for post-conviction testing to basically retest pretty much everything in the case mm-hmm. with some sort of new DNA analysis.
I noticed that she very quickly withdrew the pro se appeal that he drafted. I talked about that last week on the show about how the dynamics of all that work.
Yeah.
And how I was like, wait a minute, what, because he could be blowing one of his chances at appeal.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's... What he filed was not cognizable anyway, because it's not. You have to have a sounding board, a jumping board, a jumping off point, in order to have a basis for an appeal years and years after the conviction. You can't just say, "Well, I just thought of something." It's got to be newly discovered, right? Or some change in the law that's retroactive that affects your constitutional rights in a way that's meant to apply retroactively, something like that.
Yeah.
But I should talk to Mike about. The book. I know every time I had to have a pretrial conference with him, he was busy writing his book. So now it's done.
Now you know what he was busy doing.
Yeah.
This is what he recounts in his book. He says that he got an email from, quote, a concerned citizen right after the series dropped in December. And a link took him to a blog that mentioned a woman who claimed she suspected her husband might have been involved in Halbach's murder. He tracked the blogger down to get a name and was surprised that it was to learn that it was a man that he had prosecuted for domestic violence. Well, the man was a German national and was referred to with a pseudonym and lived only a few miles from Avery's scrapyard. His wife called 911 about 18 hours after Halbach's SUV was found hidden on Avery's scrapyard. And she said he had beaten her. Later, she told investigators she found some woman's clothing hidden in her house, a gas can with blood on it in the garage, and some bloody surgical gloves in her husband's toolbox. Mm-hmm. So, he followed up on that. He reported that, and but he's convinced that that has nothing to do.
That's not the alternate killer theory.
No. Okay. But you know, at least I give him credit for at least trying to explore every avenue here. He says that that he's more convinced than ever, of his guilt.
Did he say anything about Dassey? Do you know?
He doesn't. This article didn't say anything. What he said in, I think that he probably feels really conflicted about that.
Yeah.
That
was something that just picked up after the Manitowoc DA's office wasn't involved at all anymore. They basically were not involved from the get-go. But, in terms of evidence that he would have been aware of, he would have been as aware of the Dassey situation as the rest of us, right? There's really no reason why he would have more information. But anyway, interesting. What's it called again?
It's called
Indefensible.
Indefensible. Yeah, the missing truth about Stephen Avery, Teresa Halbach, and making a murderer.
All right, I'll have to read it and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Next week. Hey, I wanted to talk about a decision that I mentioned. When we were prepping for the show.
Oh, Lord.
And this is something that, we've talked about it a little bit on the show in the past, but it's a fairly complicated concept. But when we refer to the greater latitude rule, which sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? It's like one of those names that sounds like,
it is good if you work for the state.
Hey, that's awesome. Sort of like the right to work law. Oh, that sounds good. It's really not good. But anyway, the greater latitude rule was recently applied. I'm not going to say surprisingly, but at least amongst the defense bar, it was, I guess, disheartening that many of the rules of evidence that are there to protect innocent people are being really just stretched so thin that they're practically transparent. Excuse me. But the greater latitude rule, just to review, if you're not a regular listener, it's now a statutory rule. It used to be a case law principle that could be cited by the prosecution. But looking at what it means, you got to understand what character evidence is. And character evidence comes in under, Section 904 and the subsections under that, specifically 904.06 and 904.04 are the ones that are frequently cited. And what the general rule is, and this makes sense if you think about it, is that a trial should not be about whether a person's popular or unpopular, or whether the person's a good person or a bad person. It's not parading character witnesses in. So the general rule is character evidence is not admissible. And you have to find an exception if you want character evidence to come in. Now, it's almost universally the prosecution that's seeking to get the exception to the character evidence rule applied. Because they want to show that, for example, the bank robber had a particular modus operandi and that other banks he's robbed, that they know he did it in this particular unique way.
Yeah.
And then this case involves...
Which, of course, doesn't say that you're a bad person at all, right?
No. And that's what they're saying is that it's a little bit artificial, and it's always been a little bit artificial.
I know, this legal fiction that jurors walking in off the streets can make the artificial... distinction
between instruction too.
I know, of course they follow that immediately and
you're instructed
thoroughly.
Not to
you cannot use this for anything other than motive, opportunity, or blah blah blah,
or whatever the specific purpose is.
And of
you
course,
are not
all...
to assume that because the person robbed three other banks this way that he robbed this bank this
and
way.
And all they're thinking
that's
is
exactly why they let it in.
That's exactly why they let it in. It's exactly why the courts have allowed it.
So getting to the greater latitude rule,
yes. What
the genesis comes specifically from. Sexual assault cases, and there's this kind of bizarre notion that the courts came up with, which was it's really, really hard mm-hmm. to convict a stand-up guy with
nobody could
with a tie.
Possibly believe that he would do this.
Right, because he's wearing a tie.
Right.
And he looks nice in court. I mean, they actually said that when they're talking about the purpose behind the greater latitude rule, is that dude looks good. Jury's probably like, he couldn't possibly do this. So they let in all this kooky character evidence.
Because it's so difficult, we are going to allow this just to make it a little easier.
A lot easier.
A lot easier for the state to convict.
All right, we're going to take a break, but hold that thought because we're going to pick up right where we left off. This is Legal Defense.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. It's Kirk and John, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure I got that straight. There was some confusion in my mind that suddenly I was promoted.
Because you're talking?
And, and I don't know, I'm wearing a suit, So, anyways, okay.
Well, I want to continue with the explanation leading up to this case that came out. So, yeah, before the break, just in case you're tuning in just this moment, there was a case law created sort of subject matter of advising the courts, advising the lower level judges to give greater leeway, greater latitude to the prosecution when they have a theory that on its face might seem like it's inadmissible evidence. In other words, inviting the prosecutors to come up with new and different theories as to why, let's face it, bad character evidence can come into play. And when you look at the genesis of why the character evidence rule in its prohibition form exists, it's exactly as we fear, that trials prior to the United States invoking all of the very important rights that are part of the Bill of Rights, but also the general structure as to how trials are conducted in our country that has evolved over the years, one of the basic fundamental principles is that it is not based upon nobility. It's not based on your rank in society. It's not based on how much money you have or popularity. So, I mean, that's what those character rules are really designed to keep it, so people don't bring in a parade of witnesses to kind of vouch for one side or the other. And also, it's directly related to defining what relevance means. Because if you look at the character prohibition and the rule of relevance, in other words, is it something that makes a particular element of the offense more or less likely to be true, you know? And if you take away anything that has to do with speculation about a person's character, well, that's the general idea. So there, of course, has been ways for the prosecution to find an exception to this and bring in some, and we're talking about anything that makes the person look bad, really, is what we're talking about. And they have to find some way to make it fit. Now, when we get into the subject matter of sexual assaults, that's where this greater latitude rule really comes into play. And the idea is that, as we were saying before the break, it was envisioned that it would be very hard for the prosecution to prove that a fancy-looking person at the defense table wearing a tie and cufflinks, etc., would be capable of committing such a heinous act.
Mm-hmm.
So just in this very small category of offenses, the idea was...
Tiny little sliver.
The idea is, let's have the prosecution come up with ways to counter how good or professional the defendant appears in court.
So I think people might be somewhat educated to hear the actual language.
Okay.
Quote, "To a person of normal social and moral sensibility, the idea of sexual exploitation of the young is so repulsive that it's almost impossible to believe that none but the most depraved and degenerate would commit such an act. The average juror could well find it incomprehensible that one who stands before the court on trial could commit such an act." So they used that
Which where does that come from? The imagination of whoever wrote it.
Yes.
It's not based on data or science or anything.
No, that's just, that's called judges making stuff up as they go along to help the state, you know? So essentially what it is, you know? And it's easy to do that when you're an elected official, which they are, to do anything that's going to look like you're advocating for children or the defense of children or whatever, you know? And that's fine on its face. But when you undercut the actual process of adjudicating guilt, that's where I have a problem with it. But anyways, the point is that now they're transferring that. I know that you were leading up to that. Now they're transferring that.
Kasich just came out earlier this week. Now this same rule has been applied to a run of – I'm not going to say run of the mill, but a standard domestic abuse situation. Okay? And – applying it in such a way that it was bringing in other bad acts, essentially, on the same theory that greater latitude allows for the prosecution to really get creative. I mean, that's what greater latitude means. Get creative. Come up with weird stuff. Come up with a weird idea. And if you can sell it to the jury. Now, the thing is, I've had many trials where, especially recently, the prosecution's come up with a lot of creative ways to try and bring stuff up. And some of it's laughable. I mean, but, and it's also a little creepy in this sense because whoever we are as human beings now in our lives, there's probably some point 10, 20, 30 or more years ago where somebody could find something where you weren't in your best form. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it could be, anything. And unfortunately, what happens in a lot of these sex cases, and now apparently if it's a domestic abuse case, what they do, and this is what I find so shocking, they go back. Let's say you were married and now you're divorced. Well, guess what? The first thing they're going to do if you're charged with a crime like this, they go talk to your ex-wife or ex-husband, and they ask, okay, was there anything that concerned you about him? Was he weird? Did anything that, and then in retrospect, oh yeah, now that you mention it. And then there's all this stuff that comes into play. So then they call someone who hasn't seen your client in 15, 20 years, and they put this ex-wife on the stand and say, well, you know, when you guys used to go to parties, did he used to look at the younger women or the older women, you know, and make comments? Oh, it was always the younger women. Okay, you know, as if to try and paint him as some kind of a perv or something. But one thing I've noticed, as I was starting to say, since the prosecutors are so enthusiastic about this, the laxitude they've been given, if you want to put it that way. It's like a combination between laxative and latitude. Laxitude.
You know, I like when you make up words.
Yeah, I know.
That is really sharp.
I could run for president. So when they give them this ability to get creative, sometimes they lose their minds, and then it becomes a trial where they're bringing up stuff that the jury just kind of rolls their eyes at. And they got to be careful about that. You know, I've seen that happen where, you know, they're getting into something that the jury's like, what does this have to do with anything? And this person's obviously biased. And guess what? When they do that, that witness is going to get cross-examined up and down, left and right and sideways. Judges want to avoid mini trials, but this rule makes mini trials.
Mm-hmm.
And on every subject that they're trying to bring up, it's a little mini trial in and of itself. So in order to be fair, I always explain this to the judge. For every one of these other acts you're going to let in under the greater latitude rule, I want you to devote half a day for my cross-examination on that issue, you know, so that they're aware of the fact that it's not going to be – I'm not just going to let them bring it in and then shut up. You know what I mean? So anyway, this is a – it's interesting just because we're seeing this – starting to get applied. I know you were tapping on your keyboard there a minute ago, but did you see the case we're talking about?
Yep.
Okay. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's almost pointless.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I say that. When they codified the quote unquote greater latitude rule, they really it's kind of a play on words almost in a sense that what does that really mean? Well, it means whatever the judge wants it to mean. So they just use those terms to sort of justify what they're doing, but what they were going to do anyways.
Right.
So a lot of this stuff probably with a lot of judges would come in anyways.
Right.
Greater latitude rule or not, even if it had never existed, even if, you know, it had never been invented by our Supreme Court.
Right.
Right? So, but if you get into the actual deconstruction of the new statute, they sort of torture themselves in their statutory construction here by talking about how, well, this really applies to everything. Well, that's what it was going to be no matter what. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It really was. And so it's going to be now. It's going to be...
So where did they get this notion that just because somebody is a defendant that charged with anything, that the jury is going to be hesitant to convict because they can't imagine the person having done what they're accused of?
Yeah,
which, by the way...
Where does the burden of proof go, by the way?
I know. This is just dancing around it. This is ridiculous. This is utterly ridiculous.
So this is going to test our mettle here, my friend.
Yeah, you've been there, I'm sure, at a trial. You're sitting next to your client who's charged with a sexual assault, and when the judge announces what the charges are, and the jury shoots their glances.
That's all they need to hear. Sexual assault of a child? What, are you kidding me? What are we doing here? Right. Let's go hang this guy out in the yard and go home.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, that's how it tends to work.
I know. I see the look in their eyes.
It's just imaginary.
And I understand. I understand the anger. I understand the angst
about
it all.
Nobody, you know, it's not an easy proposition to deal with the fact that the jury's decision may or may not be affecting, you know, this may or may not be an actual sexual perpetrator, you know, and that's something that people are afraid of. And you know what? The prosecutors always capitalize on that. They always capitalize on that. They're not allowed to say, don't let this person go because he's going to reoffend and he's going to hunt you down and find your daughter in the middle of the night. But that's what they mean, you know, that's what they're trying to say. Well, we got to take a break and we'll be right back after these messages.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
We're back. Legal Defense. I'd say there was an interesting article in the New York Times earlier this week that was talking about really a disparity in sentencing and how there isn't really... In spite of the fact that some states, some communities have guidelines, the federal government, of course, does, their advisory, but in our state, we have guidelines for certain offenses. I know Mr. Birdsall over here was involved with when some of them were created.
Well, I was involved in fighting them.
Fighting them, that's
yes,
what I meant.
The,
you didn't create them, right?
Yes,
you
know, no, I believe me, and, I did everything I could.
And here's the funny thing, even in cases where it's one where there should be guidelines used, judges don't use them. I mean, I don't think I've had a – well, I had one, like, years ago.
You're talking about state or federal judges?
It's in state.
State, okay, yeah.
Because it was a case where you're just supposed to consult the guidelines back when that was happening.
Yeah.
And I've only had it actually happen once, you know. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen, you know. But anyway, that was a bizarre attempt.
Every time, just as an offshoot, every time there's an attempt to revamp sentencing in Wisconsin state courts,
yeah.
Like, what was the name of that decision that came down about?
Galleon?
Yeah, Galleon.
Yeah.
So Galleon's like, this is a total rewrite, and we're going to clarify everything.
Right. And then everything's and, the same.
And these factors are the ones you have to use, and we're going to, like, lay it out for you.
Yeah.
And the way it
says you have to address these things. So that when judges weren't doing it, there were appeals that went up and said, they didn't cite the Galleon factors. It's like, well, we said they had to, but what we meant was they should try.
And
by should, we meant could.
I know.
And
so
if I could, we meant you don't have
And
to.
The judges would get up there now and just say, you know, and they would say the exact same three
no
factors
change. No
that
changes.
They did before this.
Right,
and so
exactly.
That's fine. You know, I mean, but
well, anyway, there was an article about this town in Indiana that apparently sends people to prison at amazingly high rates.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a new boom in American prisons. See, we've been hearing that this is really fascinating, and I don't fully understand it. I'm trying to wrap my head around what's going on here. But in big cities and in big states, there's a trend to decriminalized. It's a trend to like get our prison population down. Right. We're doing it in Wisconsin, thank God. You know, after we went on our drunken binge of prison building in the 90s and early 2000s, just like the rest of the country did, by the way. But those were part of the whole mass incarceration boom, and of course. For example, half of our prison admissions are from three zip codes in Milwaukee. So it's like blackmail, blackmail, blackmail. And that was a nationwide boom. But now, this is some remarkable statistics. Dearborn County, which is in Indiana, it represents a new boom in American prisons, mostly white, rural, and politically conservative, right? So from 2006 to 2014, annual prison admissions dropped 36% in Indianapolis, 37% in Brooklyn, 69% in Los Angeles, 93% in San Francisco, right? That's the big city. In small county, in Dearborn County, in 2014, they sent more people to prison than San Francisco or New York.
And what's the biggest city in Dearborn County?
That's
probably nothing.
It's very tiny. I don't know.
Isn't that in Michigan?
Well, the problem is that it's sort of a prison industrial complex thing where prisons mean jobs. Those are, go up to
Wapaw.
It's
about like closing a military base if you start sending fewer people to prison. Yeah.
Kind of, so we got to fill those beds. So Dearborn County, let's see here. It had new inmates per 10,000 residents. They were at about 120. The Indiana average was about 25.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's not more pronounced violent crime in Dearborn County.
No, these are like your run of the mill, and you hate to use that term, but it's kind of true. Run of the mill drug cases, run of the mill felonies. There's some awesome examples. I mean, awesome like awesomely horrible. Mm. But this guy sold 6.8 grams of heroin. Guess how much he got in prison time?
Well, I already know, so it won't be a guess.
Okay, well then
35 years.
35 years.
Yeah.
Now, they compared that to the likely sentence in several other places, like Brooklyn, he would have got 0 to 3. Cincinnati would have got 2 to 5. San Francisco, 0 to 3. Another guy admitted to 10 burglaries. Likely sentence in Brooklyn, 4 to 7. 4 to 5 in Cincinnati, 2 to 4 in San Francisco. Guess how much in Dearborn County?
I'm going to guess 20.
31.5.
Oh.
How about selling 15 oxycodone? Codone pills.
Based upon the similarity to the heroin case, I would say 20.
12.
12, okay. Yeah. Still pretty bad.
So what's up with that?
Well, I think there are listeners out there right now that are saying, there's nothing wrong with that. And I'm not mocking you when I say that. They're saying, there is nothing wrong with that. I'll say it in a regular voice. And I think that's a very common reaction when people hear about harsher sentences, which is why political candidates go to the political well when they want to get reelected. They just say they're going to get tougher on things. But the reality is that we don't do society any better by simply passing our problems on to our own little subculture that we've created, a sub-society of people that are incarcerated, because we don't operate on the principle that people receive long-term incarceration for minor offenses. We can agree with that, right? Judge Griesbach up in Green Bay wrote a very good opinion once, and he said when he's talking about severity of penalties and why you have to have proportionality in sentencing, why it's important to society. He said
that's what judges do. That's the hard part about being a judge.
Yeah. But he said, and this was brilliant. He said there is no doubt that if we started implementing the death penalty for parking violations, that parking violations would go down. There is absolutely no doubt of that. But would it be just, and is it the kind of thing that we want to have as a society? No, because it doesn't actually promote people parking well. What it does is it promotes fear and distrust of the government.
Mm-hmm.
What it ends up doing is that people don't drive cars because they're for fear that they might be unjustly accused of parking.
This brings up an adjacent issue. which is, I'm sure you read about the new president of the Philippines.
Yes.
He has conducted, in the 2 months that he has been in office, I think it's about 2,200 extrajudicial killings of drug dealers. Now, by that, I mean about 1,800 were by the police, but the rest were all by vigilantes, which he's encouraging, by the way.
Right.
And
is this the same guy that said he was going to swear at President Obama's mother or something?
Yes.
Like that? Okay.
Yeah. And President Obama said, you know what, I'm just going to bypass the Philippines on the way back.
Doesn't sound like that's a worthwhile meeting.
I spent a lot of time talking about this on the show when I was in Wyoming, but because I was just aghast that we didn't even get to the fact finder part of the whole judicial process. We're just doing it on the street.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like, I don't know, it's a different side of the same coin, I guess.
You know what? I think something they should teach people more in high school is how the Nuremberg trials were conducted. Because, granted, it wasn't the absolute perfect judicial system, but when every other country was fighting for, arguing for summary execution of all the Nazis, it was the United States that took the lead and said, no, we're going to have actual judicial proceedings with fact-finding and lawyers representing these people.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how despicable they are or how bad it was. And the result, there were some people, I don't know exactly how many, but some were acquitted. You know, in that process, and others that otherwise would have been hung were not hung.
There was a very interesting movie about I forgot the name of the title of it, but it was really fascinating. I think it was really well done, first of all, but it was fascinating to kind of hear the other side. You know, mm-hmm. What do you hear when you think of Nazis? What do you think of?
Oh yeah,
very very bad people,
sure,
very evil people doing very evil things, right? But a lot of people that were just average citizens of Germany, they were sort of got sucked
in. I think I know what you're talking about. There was a movie that talked about how, I mean, these were people that didn't have any, first of all, knowledge about what was even going on, but also they didn't run down to the local political office and sign up to be a Nazi. There are lots of people that ended up joining the party simply because they were business owners and couldn't afford not to.
Right.
And it just meant that they were affiliated that way. And,
right.
But it was fascinating just because of the culture of fear that they described that forced them to take these actions. I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name of the
movie. Yeah, yeah.
Someone's going to call us.
But I think the point is that, you know, I mean, our desire, our being the American people, desire to have a fair, balanced judicial process mm-hmm. that's going to be even-handed is it's a continual struggle.
Right.
I mean, they've pretty much abandoned it in the Philippines. And we're kind of, in some senses, abandoning it just in gradations here.
Right.
With decisions like
this, exactly, the one that we're talking about earlier.
Yes.
And what that does is it happens in such small doses that people don't notice.
Right.
Is what's happening.
That's exactly right.
Time for another break, but we'll be right back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. So what we were
we started out
talking about prisons, and then we got over to Nazi trials, and then we actually doubled back to that original case that we were talking about for the greater latitude rule. You know, because it's all interrelated.
It's like a giant fabric of karma. A tapestry.
Well, you made a really good point, I thought, which was which you do quite often, by the way.
Oh, well,
but thank you. But the point was is that the lessening of the fairness of the system comes in such small doses that even people within the system don't notice.
Right.
Or the worsening of the system, for example, the ramping up of penalties for drug cases in the 80s and 90s. You know, the war on drugs. I mean, people, in some senses, even people within the system, we were working in the system at that time. You know, we kind of noticed, but we were too busy like trying to stay afloat,
right,
to do anything about it. But
like when the crack guidelines came out, that was
oh my God.
I remember, and part of it was, it's interesting. I don't know if the DEA or other drug type people put as much of the spin on it as they used to, but they used to say, I remember hearing crack cocaine's 100 times more deadly.
Yes, it's more addictive, which is demonstratively not true.
Yeah, that it's actually not.
Pharmacologically, it's identical.
It's equally addictive, yeah, yes. But it's cheaper. That's all. I mean, that's all there is to it.
Well, that's just code for black people use.
Right, exactly. That's what it is.
Crack and white people use cocaine. So.
Right. And, but, God, we got fed so much stuff during those years. And it was fear. We were fed fear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny that all it really did is it means that we spent a lot of money to really make no progress whatsoever in society. I mean, we've got just as much of a more serious drug epidemic going on right now that has nothing to do with marijuana or cocaine or mm-hmm. any of that stuff that have always been around.
Talking about oxy?
Yeah, I'm talking about opiates that are out of control now. And hey,
part of that is big pharma is out of control,
right?
And unfortunately,
Columbia now it's
doctors turn into they're the drug dealers, really, right. Aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, but you're right, selling fear. That's what politicians do best. That's what Donald Trump's doing.
Oh, yeah.
And really, that's what George Bush did very successfully for years.
Yeah.
But really, in a sense, it's even above these individuals. It's more like our upper ruling class, and by that I mean the Koch brother types, the super rich, the ultra rich, that really control corporate America, mm-hmm. that is, in essence control Congress and the United States. In a sense, we always have had an enemy, right?
Yeah,
in this country.
If you don't have an enemy, you have to have something wrong.
So we were really happy when, Tsarist Russia first showed up in 1917. And then we had a beautiful enemy for years,
served its purpose for a long time.
Yeah, really, and then post-war, it was like the Soviet Union was the perfect enemy.
Yeah.
It was like a big enemy. But now, it's even a better enemy. ISIS and terrorists are even better enemies, and here's why: is because they aren't big state actors; they're little tiny, and they can keep this going forever and ever.
They're like nanobots.
It's like we can't invade another country because
right.
they don't have one. They're in another country.
They're everywhere.
Right, and so it's kind of like the perfect enemy to constantly keep us off balance.
Mm-hmm.
And 9/11 is tomorrow, so this is a perfect time to talk about it. I mean, it's. It's like we've watched all tiny little.
By the way, I don't know if you. I always thought they should do this, and they're actually doing it this year, where they just play the news broadcast, like kind of from start to finish, from 9/11, rather than someone commenting on it and everything, but a replay of the newscast
right.
from that day.
Right.
And I saw an ad for it on TV that they were going to be doing that.
Really? So, who's doing that?
I would totally
watch that, except I'm going to be at the Packer game.
Well, yeah. But I think leading up to it, it's on one of those channels that does, like, the American Heroes channel, something like that. But yeah, they're going to be basically, from what I understand, it's Good Morning America. They're talking about, horse racing or something like that. And then all of a sudden, oh, we've just received word that apparently there's a plane crash of some sort at the World Trade Center. We'll keep you updated. And then it just sort of unfolds
back to who was best in show for the dog show.
Right, and then they pop back in.
But the thing, post 9/11, of course, changed everything, but boy, talk about making it easy to sell fear.
Hey, I want to, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is a political ad on right now. I believe it must be a Ron Johnson ad, because it's criticizing Russ Feingold for having...
I'm pretty sure then it's not a Russ Feingold ad.
Right, no. It's not a Russ Feingold ad.
I'm just going to take a shot in the dark.
But I'm saying it might be a third-party ad.
Okay, right. One of those. Yes, I understand.
And they say... Because there's the Feingold ad where he says, this is how we're going to keep America safe. This is how we're going to challenge ISIS. This is how we're going to go after it. And he's confident. He makes sense. And then it says, really? Keep our country safe? He's the only senator that voted against fighting terrorists. They're talking about the Patriot Act.
That was the vote that made me an instant Russ Feingold fan.
Yeah.
99-1. He's the one holdout.
And there is not a single senator right now who's an acting senator that can justify the decisions that were made, which, by the way, were reversed by the same Senate.
Mm-hmm.
The same legislative body scaled back all the things that Feingold was objecting to.
Yeah.
Because it was, talking about overreach, it was just, let's get rid of everyone's rights wholesale.
Well, it was, if you remember, that was passed in October of 2011.
Yeah.
I mean, just like literally 6 weeks after 9/11.
Let's give the law enforcement.
It was their wish list of
everything they ever wanted.
Everything, and they just like
we wish enforcement. By the way, that's what we're talking about. Everything that law enforcement folks wanted but couldn't get because of things like fairness or the Constitution, and they were like, hey, if only
separation
we could access
of powers,
everyone's cell phone. If only we could access these records without having to get a warrant. If only we could wiretap people and just gather all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they wanted to make the country a safer place? No.
We just want to make it safe, Kirk. For God's sake.
Well, it didn't make it safe.
But now we're getting conditioned to long lines at airports. And, it used to be that when I was a kid, you were the same thing, uh-huh. I'm sure. You walked right up to the gate to go meet somebody at an
at an airport. That happened all the time. I remember walking onto a plane with I think I was bringing 6 or 8 bottles of wine with me. I mean, as a gift. Gifts. Yeah. I wasn't going to drink them on the plane.
No, that's...
You just walked right
which would
the
be fine if
stuff.
You were.
I think I must have been 19 or something at the time. Which was the legal drinking. I was legal at 19,
So. Okay, I understand. I was not questioning.
All right, you gave me a funny look. What were you doing? But yeah, I mean, we've become accustomed to it. And, I can't say that I disagree with the idea that it's okay to be inconvenienced in that way because the subject matter that we're talking about. But what about this? I mean, border searches are incredibly invasive and extensive. Mm-hmm. And I know that it hasn't happened to me, but I know lawyer friends of mine have had their laptops, searched because they're crossing an international border. And it contains every laptop that's in the possession of a lawyer is going to contain some kind of confidential information. Mm-hmm. It's not allowed under the state bar rules to allow others access to client information. I've got information on my laptop right now that we all do.
Yeah, of course.
Stuff in our emails, things that are protected that way. But, the freedoms that we've given up one bit at a time. How do you feel about going through all the rigmarole at the airport? Does it really upset
you? Well, This is interesting. I took a behind-the-scenes tour of Mitchell International as part of a Rotary thing. And so we got to go underneath all of the baggage claim areas and stuff into where they bring the bags in. And then we got to meet all the guys. Like, we saw all the...
They all have, fancy clothes and watches on and stuff?
Yeah, it was like the Jetsons. No.
Like all the stuff they got from the bags.
But actually, they showed how they separated the bags and they x-rayed them. And then we learned about what they look for. So, and then we went to this room where they open the bags to search them if they look suspicious, right? Mm-hmm. And you know what the biggest thing is that flags somebody for a search?
A lock?
Cheese.
Oh, because it looks like plastic explosives.
Looks like C4, right.
Yeah, you know what? I had cheese in my backpack, and that held me up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we watched them actually doing it, and, these guys were incredibly thorough. And, in a way, I kind of appreciate what they're trying to do, But the thing now is we've kind of disabled Al-Qaeda. They were interested in the Broadway show of terrorism.
Right.
They wanted to knock down huge buildings. They wanted to do that. Now, what is it now? Oh, lone wolf. You know what? You guys, if you're inspired by us, go kill somebody. We're not even going to bother with the border crossings anymore.
Right.
And so that worries me even more because how do you ever stem the tide of that?
Well, I don't think you can, but there's going to be lots of ways to try. And I think...
Well, you stem the tide of it by reconciling, by getting actually, I think, we're far afield from Wisconsin law now.
I know. How do we do that?
But I think what you do is you've got to get Islam to clean up its own house. Hmm. It's 1.4 million Muslims.
Haven't we been trying to encourage that?
1.4
for a long time?
Billion. Oh, we're out of time, but we'll have to go continue on this rant next week.
Oh, we will. We absolutely will. Okay. All right. Well, this has been Legal Defense with Kirk and John, and hope you've enjoyed it. Please tune in next week as you can every week, Saturday mornings, right here on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL. Have a good weekend.